the quantum meshing model. So let me write the Hamiltonian again. And as you can see from the way I wrote it, now I am focusing my attention on the Ising model on a chain. Okay, so I didn't put the links on an arbitrary lattice, but I have just one index I, and the Ising coupling is II plus one, so we are on a linear chain. Okay, so we saw that in perturbation theory, we can have a large G expansion and a small G expansion and see that the properties of the ground state in these two regimes are very, very different. And so we suspect that in between these two phases, there is a quantum phase transition. Quantum phase transition right now is, for us, for our goals, is a point, is a value of G called GC such that delta of GC goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit, where by delta, I mean the gap between the ground state and the first excited state. So at this moment, this is our definition of a quantum phase transition. Notice also that this is consistent with what you found in perturbation theory, because delta equals zero is exactly where perturbation theory will fail. So you cannot extend the results of your perturbation theory in one regime to the other regime if in the mean, so the a mechanism, because you did two perturbation theories that say different things, okay, then which one of the two is right? They're both right because if in the middle there is a gapless point, right? Because then you have to use two different perturbation theories on each side. But now I want to argue exactly why there is indeed a critical point, and not only that there is at least one, but I will even locate it. So we will find the exact value of this critical point. And we do it in this way. Okay, so we use a very powerful argument called the duality. So the duality is an extremely powerful way of thinking, and probably some of you have already seen things like that, and they're used in field theory or in string theory all the time. And this is the simplest possible argument of a duality that we can make, and we do it in this way. So consider, so let me draw the lattice of our spin chain. Okay, so this is the site I, and this is the site I plus one. Okay, and now let me, so this is the original lattice. Okay, now let me draw another lattice that I will call dual lattice. That is the following lattice. I associate a site to every link. Okay? So you see that to every link, I can associate in a unique way a site. Okay? And in the same way, to the sites, there is a link that connects the links in the dual lattice. Okay. So at this level right now, duality is working in the sense that to every lattice, regular lattice, you can actually associate the dual lattice in this way. You can also do it in higher dimensions. But now we need to define how our variables, that are, in our case are sigma x and sigma z, transform under this transformation. This is a definition that we have to give. Okay, so this definition will complete the duality transformation. So the duality transformation is made of two parts. First of all, we map the geometry in the dual geometry, and then we map the variables in the dual variables. And I will do it in this way. So I will define a variable tau j1, okay? And I will define it in this way. This is, so now what is j? J is a site in the dual lattice. And you can see that I can map, I can actually, because a site in the dual lattice is a link in the original lattice, I have the mapping that the site J, so I could put a tilde to remember that it is in the dual lattice, is identified with the link J, J plus one, so let me call this one I tilde, in the original lattice, right? So here I should put a tilde. And now I want to identify this variable. This must become from some mapping of the old variables. And I will choose to do this transformation. You see, the operator sigma zj plus one, operates on a link. So it's operating on the site j tilde. And I call it a tau one. Very good. And then I will also define another operator. Let me call it tau 3. There is no tau 2. And again, J tilde. And this is gonna be something a bit more weird. Let's say that I define on my lattice a site that I call zero. Okay? It's arbitrary. In fact, I can actually put periodic boundary conditions on this lattice so that it really doesn't matter which one is the site that I choose as an origin. Okay, and then let me call tau 3 at the site j tilde, this thing. So let's try to understand how it works. So this is a bit more complicated. Okay, so you see that tau 1 is this operator in which we act with the z. And let me get another color. Do we have a yellow? We don't. Let's see this one. Let's say that this site here is the origin of my lattice. Also remember I said there are periodic boundary conditions. So it's just one site that I choose. And then let J be this site. Okay, then this operator is this string that is operating with the x over all these sites. You see, I'm operating with x on all the sites starting from the origin up to j. So as you can see, it's a very non-local operator. It's a string. Okay, I can do that, right? It's mapping. Yep.
So how do we decide which is the best mapping for to do this kind of a transformation? Because it doesn't...
No, but this is a definition. I call duality transformation this transformation.
Yeah, that's true. But for any other kind of lattice, we need to have some kind of intuitive idea of what we...
You'll see. Give me a second. You'll see. So, the mathematical definitions are only justified by what they do. So let me show you what this definition does. And then you will see if it's interesting or not. But you are absolutely right that one should not just drop definitions there. Then you have to do something with it, and what it does gives it some meaning. Okay, so before we see what this mapping does, let's try to understand what these variables are. Okay, so let's make some calculations. Let's try, so these are operators, right? And we want to understand what is the algebra of these operators. So for instance, let me take pi 1 at any site j, and from now on, I can drop the tilde. It is very clear what I mean. Okay? Pi 1j, and let me square it. What is this? Help me. Good. It is the identity. So this is the identity. And what about tau 3j squared? Also is the identity. These are products of polymatrices. Each polymatrix does square to the identity. So also these two operators square to the identity. Okay. Now what happens if I take tau 1 at the site I and tau 1 at the site j? And I and j can be anything you want. Do they commute or not?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. What about tau 3 and tau 3?
Yes.
They commute. Okay, so they commute. I will not write it. It's obvious they commute, right? Because these are only made of z operators. These are only made of x operators. So now the interesting thing is tau 1 and tau 3. Okay. So what happens if I consider tau 1 at the site j and tau 3 at the same site j? So let's try to understand what it means. For instance, let me actually think I should have done like this. So the string has to get up to J. Okay. Okay, so let me do another drawing for this. So we have, so let this be the site J. So this is the term jj plus 1, right? And it has zz. And then the string to the site j is this string. And this is doing x, x, x. OK, so these are the two operators of which you want to know the commutation relations. What do they do? So remember, by x, 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 I mean this is the tensor product of x, 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 and this is the tensor product of z, z. And they are the identity everywhere else. So you see that on each factor, like Okay, so the blue operator, remember our convention, means it is the identity here, right? And it is the identity here. So we have to check on the whole Hilbert space what happens. So when something is white, it's the identity. And when it's colored, it's something non-trivial. Okay, so do they commute here?
Yes.
Do they commute here?
Yes.
And they commute here, and they commute here, right? The only place where we need to wander is here. Okay. Do they commute or not? And what do they do? Anti-commute. Okay, so this completes the algebra of these operators. And you can recognize this algebra. You already know it. What algebra is it? Huh?
Polymetric.
It's the algebra of the Pauli operators. So you see, these these variables sigmas that have the algebra of the Pauli operators, this means that each of these operators is acting on a two-dimensional vector space, are mapped into the new variables that are new Pauli operators. So they are also acting on a new two-dimensional vector space. So this means that my model is mapped from a spin chain to another chain also of spins. So this maps a spin chain into a spin chain. And now we would like to understand how the Hamiltonian, now that we have defined the mapping, we want to understand under the duality mapping how the Hamiltonian H that is in the sigma variables, so let me write H sigma, and it is a function of G, okay, maps onto some Hamiltonian tau. And we will see what the function, this is also a function of G, right? Must be. So let's do it. Okay, so let's start with this term, the second term, because this is easiest. What does this term map into? It is minus J, the sum over all the sides of the dual lattice of tau 1. Okay. And now we need to understand this term. This is slightly more complicated. Do you have any idea?
Adjacent.
So basically, I am trying to invert this transformation. Yeah, who said adjacent?
Adjacent to tau
3. Okay, let's say. So let's say what happens, let's say if this is true, if I compute tau 3j plus 1, then what is that I'm doing? I am doing a string of x's up to j, and then another string of, and then I'm multiplying it by another string of x's up to j plus 1. Okay, and as you can see, all these products square to the identity, so I have the identity everywhere, and then I'm left with the sigma x on j plus 1. Okay, so this term that is sigma x at j means this is actually j minus 1 j. Okay, so I can write it here. Maybe I should make some room. This maps to H in the variables tau And we say this is equal to minus j, the sum over j of tau 1j. And then we have a minus gj, the sum over j. And then I should write tau 3j minus 1 tau 3. But because we are on a ring, I can just write the same thing as before, right? Doesn't matter. And that's very interesting. Because now you see that the Ising model in the variables G goes almost into the Ising model. Right? Because again, we have a tau 1 that is anti-commuting with the tau 3. But there is a difference that before, in the original Ising model, the coupling was a GJ. And now the coupling is J. Okay, so one thing that I could do is to, let me see if I did it right. Yeah. Is let me collect the variable G, the coupling G. So this is G that multiplies minus J over G for sigma J tau 1J. Okay, minus J sigma J tau 3 tau 3. Okay, so now you see that what I have in the square parenthesis is exactly the same Hamiltonian as before, just with G having the value 1 over G. So I'm saying that this Hamiltonian is equal to G times the Hamiltonian in the tau variables for this value being 1 over G. Do you agree? So think of this for a sec. Right? Here I have exactly the Ising Hamiltonian. So I have an energy scale J, and then I have a coupling here that is 1 over G. This 1 over G is what I call the G here. But I had to collect this number so that this is exactly what I'm getting. Yes?
So isn't it the way around, like H tau is equal to, we start with H tau and this is J times A, we find again H sigma with one of the P. Can you find it all?
Oh, yeah. I think you're right. I think you're right. Sorry. Yes. Thank you.
The question, does it change something? The fact that now we have, I don't know if it makes a big difference, but we're using now tau is really non-local, whereas before we had the...
It does matter, yes. It does matter. So this means that under this mapping, you should not expect that things that have directly to do with the locality are conserved. So for instance, if a variable that is a local variable in the first model is condensing, by condensing means it has a non-zero expectation value in the ground state, then the variable that is condensing through the mapping in the new model, if you express it in terms of the operator on the original lattice, will not be a local variable anymore. So these things are not conserved by the map. Everything else that has nothing to do with the locality, it is. For instance, one thing, because of this, so because the Hamiltonian maps exactly in this way, then the spectrum maps exactly in this way. Right? Because you just write the spectral resolution of this Hamiltonian. So for every, it must be true for every eigenvalue. And so you can write that, okay. So this means that the energy for the value g of one model is equal to g, the energy at the value 1 over g. Right? What I'm saying is that if I take my Hamiltonian, I compute my Hamiltonian for the value of the parameter 1 over g, and then I multiply by g, I have the same Hamiltonian as before. So also the corresponding eigenvalue must be the same. So the fact that this Hamiltonian goes into itself is called self-duality. So this model is special because under a duality transformation goes into itself. Okay, so this is called self-duality. And you have this relationship. Okay. So this is true for every eigenvalue E. Okay? So in particular, it is true for the eigenvalue, for the first eigenvalue and the next one, which means the ground state and the next excited state. So if I take the difference of these two eigenvalue, this relationship still holds. And you have delta E for the value G must be equal to G delta E for the value G to the minus 1. Okay. Now I make an assumption. Okay? Now I'm making the assumption that because I have only seen two different phases, I'm making the assumption that there is only one, if there is a critical point, is at most unique. Okay? So this is an assumption based on the fact that I've only seen two phases. It's not a proof. We will prove it that there is only one critical point when we diagonalize today exactly the model. Right now I'm saying, based on this physical argument, if there is a critical point, it is at most unique. Okay? There is only at most one value of g such that delta is equal to 0. Okay, now you see something like this. Imagine that delta E is equal to 0 for some value of g. But then this value of g must be equal to g to the minus 1. Because if delta E is 0 at g, it's also 0 at g minus 1. So g is equal to g to the minus 1. Delta E 0 means g is equal to g to the minus 1, which means g is 1. So if there is a unique critical point, it must be located at g equal 1. So you see that this is a very powerful argument, because by just doing a mapping, I'm not diagonalizing anything, I know where the critical point is located. Okay. Before I diagonalize the model, we need to make some comments about our notion of quantum phase transitions. And this will actually bring us to some of the questions that already arose in this audience. So, in fact, the model that I want to diagonalize will be a slightly different model, which is a generalization of this model. It's called the quantum XY model. Which is a bit richer because it has more parameters. So let me write it. This is given by minus h, the sum of sigma zi, and then minus the sum from 1 to n. So we have n spins. This is a spin chain. And now we have 1 plus eta over 2, sigma xi plus 1. Plus 1 minus eta over 2, sigma y I plus 1. No, sorry, z here, z. Because the, oh, no, this is z, so this is x. Okay, did well. That's it. Yeah. Okay, so you see that this model has two parameters, not just one. Eta and h are independent. There is not an overall energy scale j. If I want to put another overall energy scale j, I just need to put it everywhere. And I'm basically choosing j equal 1. Yeah?
Just a question from the last part. So g equal to 1 is just the value where the energy gaps predicted by both become the same, but not necessarily the same.
No. As you can see, for every g, the gap at g is equal to the gap at g to the minus 1 times g. For every g. And for every gap. Now I'm saying, let's say that I look at the gap with the first excited state, and I'm saying it is 0. Then if it is 0 at g, must be also 0 at g to the minus 1. But because this value is unique, g must be equal to g to the minus 1. And therefore is 1. Okay. So notice that for eta equal 1, then we have the Ising model. Do you agree? Yeah, the way I wrote it, there was x here before and z, but it's the same thing. It's really the same thing. So, as you can see, while before we had the phase diagram that was a line, and it was the variable g that now I called h, now I'm expanding the phase diagram because I'm also putting a variable eta. Okay, so this, before I set out to diagonalize this model, since we see that we can expand our phase diagram at will by adding more terms to the Hamiltonian, there is a question that arises that is a bit disturbing. Okay, so let me rewrite the Ising model. Okay, so I have minus h sigma x minus nothing sigma z. Okay, this is what we had so far. This was my h variable. So I could just add another variable, lambda, just like I did before. I added eta, and I decided that the coupling eta basically adds this term, right? Now I could add some lambda or eta, call it what you want, and sum over z.
What do you mean by sum over z?
Sorry, no, it's my impaired speech. And sum over sigma z. Sorry about that. Okay. Good. So now this is our phase diagram. We know that for h equal 1, the system becomes gapless at lambda equal 0. Right? Because at lambda equal 0, it's the ISIM model. We just found that the model here is gapless. And we know that on this line, this is a paramagnet. And this is a ferromagnet, means the order parameter condenses as an expectation value that is different from zero. Okay. So we know that if I move this way, at some point, I find something gapless, and I have a quantum phase transition, and then I say, oh, this is another phase. And now remember that our definition of a phase was a domain of analyticity. Okay? So in order for the ferromagnetic phase to be a phase, I should have something like this. I don't know. Let me draw some. And all this line should be a line of criticality, which means of gaplessness. In this case, this is a domain of analyticity, and this is another domain of analyticity. But if I don't have a line like this, or even if I have a line that has a hole, then everything is a domain of analyticity, but that line. So I do not have two different phases. And this is indeed the case because this lambda term opens, in fact, a gap between the ground state and the first excited state. So yesterday you did the perturbation theory. And so what you could do again is after we diagonalize the model exactly, now with this term, the model is not integrable anymore. So then it's not just a choice, we are forced to do perturbation theory, and you can show that this opens a gap. So there is a unique critical point here for this model. So in some sense, everything is in the same phase. Because of our definition of what is a phase. It's a domain of analyticity. This thing also happens in classical phase transition. If you think of water, you have the phase diagram of water is something like this, and this is a liquid. And this is a gas. And as you can see, you can actually go from a liquid to a gas without ever encountering a non-analyticity in the free energy. So according to our definition of phases, vapor and liquid water are in the same phase. In fact, it is correct. They are in the same phase.
So what's the origin of this discontinuity, or this analyticity?
These ones?
Yes.
Those are classical critical points.
Yes, but we have also the quantum counterpart.
Yeah, no, all I'm saying is that if you define so in this case, so you want to know in general why? So you want to know in general why there are classical phase transitions?
I'm asking in the general phase diagram why we have a
line segment instead of a whole line for the face.
Oh, well, but the reason why this stops here, why a face diagram is a given face diagram is a very complicated matter. You need to solve the model. In fact, I'm not even sure. I think that this model is known to be like this basically experimentally. And there is some molecular simulation of it. But, you know, water is actually very complicated.
Yes.
That's why we do toy models, because, you know, at least we can understand in a way that we can solve them. But now I have please, let's go back to the original, because here we have a serious conceptual problem, right? So if it seems that my definition of quantum phases that looked so sensible, I can very easily overcome it because, you know, I add one more parameter and then I can get around. I can get around my critical point. And even if I found this dome here, then I could probably add another parameter and get around it. Because who tells me that this dome extends at infinity like this? Since I have a very large freedom of terms that I can add to a Hamiltonian, it seems that there is always a path in the space of all the possible local Hamiltonians such that I can connect two different ground states in two different phases without encountering a phase transition. Then on what grounds I'm saying there are different phases? If all my definition was based on the fact that to go from one to the other, I encounter a phase transition. So you see, this is a serious, very serious problem. But we do have a solution. So when I do this, I'm getting very warm. When I do this, what is that is dramatically changing in this Hamiltonian? So look at it. When I add lambda, can you please raise your voice?
Changing the symmetry scope.
Perfect. Okay. So before, when lambda is equal to zero, remember the symmetry properties of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian was commuting with the T that was flipping all the spins. Now, with lambda different from zero, what happens? This is not symmetric under flipping the spins, right? Because every time I flip any spin, I pay an energy lambda. You see? If this gives me energy minus lambda every time a spin is down. Sorry, it's up. I flip that spin, I pay an energy lambda. So actually 2 lambda, right? Because I go from minus lambda to plus lambda, 2 lambda. So this Hamiltonian is not symmetric under T anymore. Okay, so if it is not symmetric anymore, in going from here to here, I'm not breaking any symmetry. Because in order to talk about symmetry breaking, it means that we are breaking a symmetry of the parent Hamiltonian, or the Hamiltonian. The ground state is breaking a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. But if the Hamiltonian does not have that symmetry, there is nothing to break. In other words, quantum phases have to be understood as way of breaking the symmetry, which means we have constraints in the way we make our phase diagram. This means I consider all the Hamiltonians that are Z to symmetric, or then I cannot do that. Then this phase is different from this phase because they break the symmetry in a different way. But if I consider all the Hamiltonians, regardless of symmetry, then it is true that this phase is the same than this phase. Because the only thing that distinguishes this phase from this phase is some symmetry property. Whether the magnetization, the order parameter, what is the order parameter? Sigma z is the operator that breaks the symmetry. So it's the operator that breaks the symmetry that is condensing or not condensing the two phases. But if you don't care about symmetry, then this difference doesn't make any sense. And they are the same phase. So the way we understand quantum phases is that, imagine this is our space of all the possible parameters, and this splits in many symmetries of the parent Hamiltonian. Okay. And then inside a given symmetry, there are ways of breaking the symmetry. So this is symmetry breaking one, symmetry breaking two, symmetry breaking three of the symmetry T1. And then another for another Hamiltonian that has a different symmetry, then you have T2, and you still have some symmetry breaking here. So you have symmetry breaking one of the symmetry T1, and symmetry breaking two of the symmetry T2, and so on and so forth. But if you disregard the symmetry, then there is a transformation that connects all of them. Okay. So now the question is this picture complete? Are all the possible quantum phases of quantum systems that the only constraint that they have is that they must be local? We argued why they must be local. Does this exhaust all the possible quantum phases? Or there are exotic types of quantum states? We will see. Okay, so now it's time to diagonalize this model. So the way it works is that I will give a sketch of the proof with all the important passages without doing the calculations. And today in the tutorial, you do all the tedious calculations. Okay. All right. So this is my Hamiltonian. We have a periodic boundary conditions, which means that the spin at the site n plus 1 is equal to the spin at the site 1. You can actually play with these boundary conditions. You can put them anti-periodic. For instance, it could be minus sigma 1. Or you could put a phase, so a continuous twisting of the boundary conditions. And this method works for whatever way you put the boundary conditions. Only some effects become more apparent than others. Okay. So the first step to diagonalize this Hamiltonian is the so-called Jordan-Wigner transformation. This is a non-local transformation. It's based on defining new variables that are strings, okay? Just like we did before for our duality. And the goal of this transformation is to transform something that is a theory with spins one up, in something that has fermions. Okay? So basically, we map our Hilbert space in the Hilbert space of spinless fermions, in which you have at every site two degrees of freedom that are 0 and 1, which means I have a fermion at that site, or I do not have a fermion at that site. Actually, the other way around. Zero is I have no fermion. One is I have a fermion. Okay. Okay. So the Jordan-Bingham transformation that realizes this mapping is the following. So I will call sigma zeta I equal to C dagger I C I. Okay. So you see, I have a mapping between the sigma z variables at the site I to the CI variables. Now this must be fermionic operators. Sigma X, sigma I, and here I will have some mapping with the C and C dagger. Okay, so the first part of the mapping is this, minus one. And this defines, let me call it rho I minus one. So rho I is just C dagger I C I, which is the number operator, right? It tells you this operator has eigenvalue 1 if there is a fermion, and it has eigenvalue 0 if there is no fermion. So the total number of fermion, NF, is the sum over all the sites of C dagger I C I. Okay, so this part is local. This looks very much like what we were doing before with our duality transformation. But before I was mapping spins into spins, now I'm doing something different. Mapping spins into fermions. The other part of the transformation is sigma minus, which as you remember is sigma x minus I sigma y over 2. So it is 1 up, so this is defined at sigma x minus I sigma y. I map it into C at the site I, and now I have the string, I have this string. So this is the exponential of a sum. So it is a string. Later today, during the tutorial, you will actually make it explicit. So okay, so this is the mapping. And why I claim that these are fermions, I cannot just say, oh, because I call them C, they're fermions. What makes them fermions? The algebra. Perfect. So we need to check the algebra. So you will check that if you take the anticommutator of CI dagger CJ, CI CJ dagger, sorry, I get delta IJ, whereas CI CJ and CI dagger CJ dagger are zero. So we have the right algebra of spinless fermions. Okay, now there is, the tedious job of plugging this transformation in here and see what we get. Okay, so this will be the first exercise in the tutorial. And what do you get? What you get in the C variables is, so let me write this. We have minus C dagger I CI plus 1 plus C dagger I plus 1 CI plus eta C dagger I plus one, C dagger I plus CI, CI plus one. Then you have another term that looks exactly like this, but it is a local term, so it's not a sum. It has minus Cn C1 plus C1 dagger Cn plus eta C dagger plus Cc. We have one n and one. Okay. Okay, and then finally, the term in H. Which contains sigma z, which is that 2 c dagger c I minus 1. Okay, so it becomes this. It doesn't look like we're in a much better shape. But then next thing we do. Well, we are in a better shape because now we see that these are all quadratic operators. You know, that's a big deal when you have matrices. Notice, by the way, so this is also something that you have to check, that H and NF, NF is that operator, the total number of fermions, commute. So this is a good quantum number. You can diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the space of a given number of fermions. At this point, you do a Fourier transform. So you have Ck is equal 1 over square root of n. Okay, so L is my site index, and K times A is my momentum. So, but A is just a parameter. You can interpret A as the lattice spacing, okay? So you could say, I have N spins, you could say that the length of the chain is L equal N times A. For all practical purposes, you can send A to 1. It's just a useful parameter because when you send it to 0, then you could do the continuous limit of this theory. Okay, so this is the Fourier transform. And so K goes from minus pi over A to pi over A. You can just imagine it goes from minus pi to pi. You can fix A equal to 1. And it is quantized in this way. Okay. So it doesn't take continuous values, right? It is quantized in this way. Just like J or L are quantized, right? So there are N values, capital N values of Kn, then it becomes periodic. Then you go over them again. Okay, what does the Hamiltonian become? The Hamiltonian becomes, now I will write it in a block diagonal form, which will be operating on the space of a pair of fermions with momentum k and minus k. Okay? So I will have this vector, c dagger k, c dagger minus k. So you see, this is the vector that creates a pair of fermions with momentum k and minus k. And then I have this column vector here. And then I have the sum over all k's. I have some Hamiltonian that is a 2 by 2 Hamiltonian. Okay. So I'm running out of time. It is a 2 by 2 Hamiltonian. With some numbers, this number contains h and eta. So you see, my Hamiltonian has become block diagonal. So for every momentum, I have a 2x2 Hamiltonian. So now this can be diagonalized easily. It's a 2x2 matrix. And the transformation that diagonalizes this Hamiltonian is called Bogoliubov transformation. Okay? So it will be of the form, you will have some operators, dk, that have ak ck plus bk c dagger k, something like that. Right? I'm going from these variables to these variables to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. This is called the Bogoliubov transformation. Okay, so what happens after Bogoliubov transformation? Happens that your Hamiltonian in the D variable is diagonalized finally as this form, omega k, d dagger k, dk, plus some constant. So you see, now it is diagonalized. Now you know what is the ground state of this Hamiltonian. It's the vacuum of the decay operator. Means there are no fermions. Then I start populating my Hamiltonian by adding fermions with energy omega k. Remember, they always come in pairs. So when I have this decay, what I will do is that I will create a fermion with momentum k and a fermion with momentum minus k. Okay, so you see, it's just three fermions. I'm just counting how many d fermions there are. Now, what is the amazing thing? The amazing thing is, what do these d fermions look in terms of the c fermions? Before I did the Bogoliubov transformation. Well, mathematically we know it's here, right? It's this transformation. Now consider the vacuum of the phi fermion, means there are no C fermions. This vacuum is not the ground state of the Hamiltonian. If this was the ground state of the Hamiltonian, means that this would be already diagonal. The ground state of the Hamiltonian is the vacuum of the D fermions. So this means that the vacuum of the C fermions is in fact populated by particles of the D type. And this is an exercise that we will do together tomorrow, because this is the simplest example. In fact, it's not even that simple, because it's actually used in this form to understand why in one reference frame there are no particles and in another reference frame there are particles. It's what in quantum field theory is known as a Hawking radiation, or Unruh effect, even if you don't have a singularity. Okay, so in a different reference frame, what is the vacuum for an observer in another different frame is populated of particles. And we will see that these particles come in entangled pairs. So, and that's very useful to understand the radiation. Okay, so you see that how all these things are connected. You know, this was just a boring spin chain. It was just the simplest possible example that of a quantum many-body system that has a phase transition, breaks the simplest symmetry that we have, that is Z2. But we can learn so much from this simplest example. Okay, so good luck today with the details of the diagonalization, and then tomorrow we talk more.